In the news.
Hey there, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
Week number two.
That's right.
Yeah. We're going to have a lot of stuff. It's interesting, during the summer, usually Professor McDaniel and I have a little trouble. Well, during past administrations, we have trouble filling the news void. Not so much, these days, but we are going to kind of cover some ground that just keeps recurring.
Yeah.
Let's get on to the news of the day. I'm leading off today. Professor McDaniel's got some heavy-hitting stuff at the back end, but we're going kind of more topics, but we'll get in and out a little quicker today. It's not quite a lightning round, but it's the bloviating professor version of that, which means we'll be done in about 4 hours probably. But all right, so I'm going to start. I got three things I want to talk about, and Professor McDaniel has some things to say about these also. But I want to talk about fundraising in the Texas elections coming up, 2018 Texas elections. I want to talk about the race in the Senate, the United States Senate. And then I want to talk just a little bit about Democrats and their strategy with respect to the nomination of Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court vacancy. So three things. So let's start with fundraising in Texas. I know I'm kind of all over the map here. Got some state stuff, got some national stuff. Let's start with the state stuff. And I want to point you guys to an article that came out by Ross Ramsey in the Texas Tribune. The Texas Tribune is a wonderful website that has detailed information, really good analysis on Texas politics. So if we could go to the Texas politics article. Here's the one. It's Texas Democratic candidates find friendly donors in hostile congressional districts. Just a few things to know about this. And I want to cursor down here. I'll show you in particular, just to read real quickly the setup here. Democratic challengers outraised Republican congressional incumbents. So these are for the United States House seats is what we're talking about, the U.S. Congress, in seven races in Texas during the second quarter of the year. But in most of those races, including the statewide contest for Senate, so they're counting the Senate race with Cruz and O'Rourke, recent election history favors the Republicans, sometimes by a wide margin. And it goes on to talk a little bit about the role of money in elections. And, you know, spoiler alert, Professor McDaniel and I do think money matters. There's a little bit of context here, right? If, McDaniel raises $2 million and Shaw raises $1,900,000, it's not clear McDaniel has a huge advantage. Well, although with his natural sexiness and charisma, you might expect that. That's right. But if McDaniel raises $1 million and Shaw raises nothing, I put a lot of money on McDaniel to win that race. Okay, so the particulars here, I want to point to this paragraph here. So let me see if I can fire up. I love this. Ooh, okay. So here's a paragraph I'm really interested in. Let me see if I can get that working here. Ah, no, all I can do is do that. Ah, hold on, I'm out. All right. The paragraph here is the seven Republican incumbents in the Texas congressional delegation were outraised by their Democratic challengers. So seven, and it includes Cruz. So you see here, Senator Ted Cruz, Reps John Carter of Round Rock, which is a pretty Republican area, John Culberson of Houston, Will Hurd, Pete Olson, Pete Sessions, and Roger Williams. And they were outdone, as here, they were outdone by some Democratic names that for now are a little less well known. Beto O'Rourke, MJ Hagar, Lizzie Pannell, Fletcher, Gina Ortiz Jones, Sri Preston Kulkarni, Colin Allred, and Julie Oliver. Right? So that's seven races, including the Senate race, where the Democrats have outraised the Republicans. Now that's a big deal in Texas. What that means is that Democratic money, and Texas is kind of close to New York for the number two spot in the country with respect to money, political money. So you've got California, which is, you know, what is it? Is it the 600 or the 800-pound gorilla of American politics? We'll call it 800, all right? California is the behemoth out there. More money comes from California than any other state. But Texas is right up there along with New York in that number two slot, right? Florida trailing. So there's a ton of political money, money to political campaigns. It comes out of the state of Texas. But because the state has been so Republican slanted in the last 15 or 20 years, the Texas money tends to go to competitive races in other states and districts in other states. And Texas Democrats have been, you know, really annoyed by that for quite some time now. So an interesting, you know, kind of feature of the 2018 elections is that you have this very competitive national race, you know, where the House is very much in play, we think, where the Senate is probably in play. Get to more on that in a second. But that money, you know, you'd think the way things have gone lately, the Texas money would be going to competitive races outside Texas. A lot of it's staying here. But on the, you know, so that could be good news for Democrats. On the other hand, a lot of the money where, you know, where these Democratic candidates have, a lot of the races where the Democratic candidates have done well, those aren't necessarily races where you expect the Democrats to win. And that's the point of Ross Ramsey's article here, is that, you know, in most of these, and in fact, let me cursor down just a little more for you here, right? And what I'll point to, in the six congressional districts, so this is the last paragraph that you're seeing visible on the screen here. In the six congressional districts where Democrats outshone Republicans in second quarter fundraising, okay, so second quarter fundraising, only one, the 23rd district, that's that kind of long district that runs, you know, basically from San Antonio all the way out into West Texas. And it's a district that's got a substantial Latino population. Only one, the 23rd, has been competitive in recent elections. Hurd won by a hair, that's the Republican incumbent, 1.3 percentage points in 2016. After successfully drawing challenging a Democratic incumbent 2 years earlier. And he'll face Gina Ortiz Jones, right? So that's the one race where the Democrat is outraising the Republican that looks competitive. In those other races, they don't really look that competitive. Sessions did not have a Democratic opponent 2 years ago. In 2014, he finished 26 points ahead of the Democratic candidate. The other four seats are testaments to very effectively drawn political maps. Each of the incumbents won easily in 2016. Culberson by 12. Williams by 20, Olson by 19, Carter by 21. So, you know, it's interesting that Democrats are raising money, but they're raising money in districts where it's going to be very, very tough for them to be competitive. It's not that the Republicans aren't raising money in these districts, it's that the Democrats are raising a ton of money. On the other hand, these are pretty Republican districts, with the exception of the 23rd. Okay, so that's sort of point one. Lots of money. The Democrats, again, I guess to kind of put a real fine point on it, the Democrats seem to be as excited, perhaps more excited than the Republicans in 2018, even in Texas. But it's not clear what the strategic implications of that are. You know, I guess you could think of it as, you know, is this money strategic or is this money expressive? And right now the money looks to be expressive, right? That is, it's, you know, people in these areas who are genuinely fired up, they're giving money in their districts. But if you were, in the Democratic Party sitting on a cloud somewhere, these may not be the districts where you would want to spend that money. Okay, so Professor McDaniel, I didn't want to monopolize this. You got any thoughts on the Democrats doing pretty well in terms of fundraising in Texas?
Yeah, I think it's part of this whole story that people want to tell of Texas, I guess, becoming purple in the sense that it becomes a competitive state. This idea that Texas will eventually become a state in which Democrats can win. Because, it was one of the prize states of the Democratic Party. If you think of Lyndon Johnson, if you think of former Governor Ann Richards, but I don't think this is going to happen as well as well. There may be some gains, but it's not going to be an overall support. And the biggest fear is that after you do see this high level of spending in these non-competitive districts, that people will see this loss as, well, give up, why do this again? And so you won't see the same amount of spending the next time around. What's important to understand is that if you spend the first time around, you got to be willing to spend the second time around. It's an issue of momentum. You got to keep things going. But a lot of times, if people don't win the first time, they're like, well, what's the point of spending? And this becomes problematic and in many ways becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay, so let's move from Texas to the national scene right now. I wanted to just briefly put up kind of an overview of the United States Senate. And there'll be a transition point here because the Senate is obviously key for judicial nominations. So a connection between my final 2 points here, one on the Senate and the other on Mr. Kavanaugh. Right here we have a map. This is from Washington Post. They've got a nice political blog called The Fix. Chris Saliza, some other people write in this thing. And it's usually got some nice data-driven analyses of American politics. And I wanted to get as recent a map as possible here. So you all are probably aware the Republicans control, hopefully you're aware, the Republicans control both houses of Congress as well as the presidency. The Democrats are looking to 2018 as with kind of licking their chops. They see an opportunity to take over the House. They need to flip, I think it's 23 or 24 seats in the House in order to take over. That's right around what one normally expects in the president's first midterm election. The Senate, however, is a little problematic, and I want you guys to see why here. Remember, the Senate has 6-year terms. Only 1/3 of the Senate is up every 2 years. Okay, so 33, 34 seats are up every 2 years. All right, that's why it's a staggered cycle. All right, this is part of the idea that the Senate is a little less responsive to public opinion than the House or even the presidency in some sense, right? It is the cooling sauce with respect to legislation. Now, what you're talking about in 2018 is the Senate class that was elected in 2012. Why is 2012 significant? That was Barack Obama's re-election. So there are a lot of Democratic senators elected in 2012 on the coattails of Barack Obama. In other words, there are Democrats representing states that aren't that Democratic. And without Obama at the top of the ticket, there are questions about whether they can make inroads. So while the Democrats are only need to flip a couple of seats in order to take the Senate, they're actually defending much more turf than they're kind of prosecuting right now. So you take a look here at the map, and you see the Democrats here, 26 seats in play. So 26, 9 Republican seats. Now, you may just say, like, wait a sec, Shaw, that adds up to 35. You said there's 33 or 34. There are a couple of special elections here. In fact, there may be an additional one. I mean, obviously, you're probably aware that John McCain of Arizona has some serious health issues, but as of right now, that seat is still McCain's. But there are going to be some states in which there are multiple elections. Mississippi is one. You see the little asterisks here. Mississippi has 2 Senate races this time because there's a retirement. Someone joins the administration, and that seat has to be filled, and then there has to be an election. So what they've got here is it's hatched. So there's blue seats representing Democratic seats, red seats representing Republican. Hatched indicates what they see to be a competitive race, a competitive race. So you notice down here in the Mountain West, Nevada and Arizona are areas where the Democrats are looking at them going, huh, you know, we could pick up those seats, maybe win the Senate. It's Ensign's seat in Nevada. This is the seat of Jeff Flake in Arizona, who's retiring. So that's an open seat race in Arizona where the Democrats look to be fielding a very strong challenge. All right, and then amongst the other red states, there's only 9 of them, Tennessee is an open seat. Bob Corker is resigning. So that's an open seat race where the former Democratic governor of Tennessee is running. That's a popular candidate there. So 3 potential pickups. You notice Texas is not hatched, even though Beto O'Rourke seems to be running a very strong campaign. The Washington Post doesn't see that as being a seat that's probably going to flip at this point. But you look at just the numbers where the Democrats are defending. So let's say they pick up all those seats. Well, they have to successfully defend in Florida, Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Missouri, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Montana. Some of these states, in fact, 6 of them, were states that Donald Trump carried by over 10 points. So, for instance, you know, you've got Missouri, you've got Indiana, you have West Virginia. West Virginia went for Trump by like 40 points last cycle. And you know, poor Joe Manchin's out there trying to convince them to, stick with him as a Democratic candidate. So, this is all by way of saying, even though the Democrats face a much narrower margin in the Senate, only a couple seats they need to flip, the map is not good. It's not 50-50. You're talking about the Obama class of 2012. Places like Indiana, Missouri, West Virginia are pretty Republican, and the Democrats, even if they pick up some of those seats in Tennessee, Arizona, Nevada, they have to hold everywhere else, and that's a very tall order. So a lot of people think even though there's, you know, you have to flip in the mid-20s in the House versus only 2 or 3 in the Senate, they still think the House is much more in play than the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that you, when you have to defend 9 and you're trying to gain 3, again, you have to keep those 9. And so that's going to be the main thing because let's say you gain those 3 but you lose 6, well, then that means you're actually 3 down. Yeah. So, again, right now, the thing about the Democratic Party is they're on the defensive, not on the offensive.
Yeah, I think that's unquestionably the case. And if you're, you know, again, looking for the places where the Democrats have the best chance to pick up, clearly, Nevada, Arizona, Tennessee. Where are they most vulnerable? North Dakota. You talk about a Republican state with Heidi Heitkamp as a Democrat defending that seat. Missouri, Claire McCaskill. She keeps winning. She's got more lives than a Siamese cat, but she keeps winning. But that's a tough race. And Joe Donnelly in Indiana and Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Those are 4 states where if the Democrats can hold 2 of those, I'll be surprised, and it might make them competitive to flip the Senate. Last thing I just wanted to mention real quickly, so that's the money situation in Texas, the national Senate races, and then I just want to briefly touch on the Supreme Court. Again, I just wanted to comment about Democratic strategy. It seems that the Senate Democrats, remember, so you know, you'll remember from our lessons on the Constitution, and we'll reinforce this when we get into the modules on institutions later on, you know, the president nominates justices to the Supreme Court. The Senate has to confirm. They have hearings, and they vote. In this case, Democrats have decided, it looks like in the Senate, most of the Senate leadership has decided they're going to oppose Kavanaugh. And there's two sort of interesting lines of argument. Now, okay, let's be perfectly candid. The main line of argument is, we think he's going to pursue a conservative, you know, brand of jurisprudence, and we don't like that. And that's not to rag on Senate Democrats. Senate Republicans have the same attitude towards President Obama's nominees, right? So let's, you know, it has nothing to do with one party being hypocritical. Both parties are hypocritical. But I would actually defend this position. The court has become very political. It's important to politics and public policy. And the notion that politics is irrelevant, I'm not so sure is a particularly compelling argument. But you need to present more than just a we don't like your politics kind of approach to do somebody in the Senate. So the Democrats have tried two lines to oppose Kavanaugh. The first is interesting. Cory Booker, a Democratic senator from New Jersey, offered the following. He said, well, the president is under suspicion, possibly under investigation in this whole Mueller FBI probe. It is inappropriate for somebody to be nominated and confirmed who would then sit in judgment of that president potentially. Okay, so that's the argument. So hold off on everything. Okay, so that's one line of argument. All right. Now, there's an obvious problem with this, and that's precedent, which is, in fact, we've seen this before. We saw it in Watergate. We saw it when President Clinton had two justices that he appointed when the special counsel was, you know, investigating Clinton's behavior. Both of them not only were confirmed, both of them sat in on cases involving evidence in the Paula Jones and the obstruction of justice case. So it's an interesting argument constitutionally and legally. It's one that has no precedent. In fact, there's precedent in the opposite direction. Another interesting argument, so that's kind of one. Shouldn't, because of all this Trump-Russia stuff, you know, the potential president could be subject to investigation that comes before the court, shouldn't, you know, do that. That, not sure that's going to have a lot of legs, right? There's a second argument, and it's a little more forceful version of the first. It's that Kavanaugh said at one point in a interview or a speech in front of the American Enterprise Institute that he agreed with the Senate allowing the special counsel law to expire. All right, and that was a law that was passed in the 80s that allowed the president to appoint a special counsel who would have investigative power over matters involving the executive branch. And there were some special counsels. Nobody really liked the way they worked. And especially after the Clinton investigations of the 1990s, when that law came up, when that statute came up for renewal, the Senate allowed it to expire. They didn't pass it. And Kavanaugh had said he agreed with that. He thought it was actually constitutionally problematic. This has been picked up by some Democrats to say Kavanaugh doesn't believe the president should be subject to an independent counsel. Okay, there's a problem with that, which is they're not the same thing. These are different things authorized by different statutes. Some of the more inflammatory, so I think Dick Durbin actually had a line that says, well, we know now that Kavanaugh does not think the president is subject to the laws of the nation. I'm not sure that's what Kavanaugh said, but you're going to get a lot of hyperbole. This seems to be, rather than the abortion argument, which is, you know, Kavanaugh would overturn Roe v. Wade and using abortion as a litmus test, it seems to be the Democrats are going more with a doesn't believe in checking the president and, you know, kind of tying Trump into this whole thing. We'll see how far that goes. I'm sort of skeptical, just with a little bit of background and knowledge of these different laws and what Kavanaugh has said. It doesn't look like he's said a whole lot, as most justices, you know, don't, on matters that are going to be of interest to the Senate. And so there's going to be a lot of dodging when these hearings begin. And it looks like they're going to begin. So,
yeah, I mean, with any Supreme Court justice nominee, people are concerned about how will this nominee affect our legacy. So if you think of the Republicans being opposed to many of the justices that President Obama put forward, is because how will this affect our legacy? Will this person kind of restrict some of the many things that we've done? And you see the same thing going on here with the idea of what will happen with Obamacare, what will happen with some of the what have seen liberal victories. And using this idea that that the appointee may not be supportive of investigating the president when you know there's a high level suspicion of the president is supposed to ring true of this idea of kind of increased corruption and things of that nature. And this is extremely problematic because one of the problems we're going to run into is if we see the court being politicized and if members of the court are all of a sudden now beginning to seen as cronies of maybe the president or Congress, where there's already a low level of respect, if the court loses its legitimacy, we're going to have a major problem in terms of understanding or actually establishing trust in government. And when that lack of trust in government boils over, you get a number of problems. And in terms of not just who was elected, but also the policies that are put forward, but also people's responses to policies. If people don't trust government, they're going to constantly fight these policies. In many ways, things that government may be trying to do that will actually help the community may actually backfire or short circuit because the public has lost their trust. And so we have to be very careful about this in terms of doing this. Now, both parties want us to not trust the other party, and that's how they've been successful. But in doing so, they have really led to the decay of trust in government in general, which has led to numerous problems for the government to actually govern itself, to carry out policies, but also for the parties to be effective in getting their things through.
I think, you know, I'll make a, you know, armchair, since I have an armchair, prediction. I think you understand the Democrats' anger over this, not only the way Obama's last purported nominee, Gorsuch, was treated, which is he wasn't given a hearing. You know, it wasn't that they voted him down, didn't get a hearing. And the Democrats will say, and I've heard Paul Begala, as a Democratic consultant, and others say that, look, you know, we've basically, you know, won the popular vote in every election since, 1992, except for the 2004 election, right? You know, Bush won in 2000 in the Electoral College, Trump won in 2016. And yet, the court is going to reflect a conservative mentality. And the court is a longer running institution and is even more kind of removed from public opinion than the Senate. And that's why Democrats are angry and scared. But I would suggest, this is my armchair prediction, I think Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed. It's a Republican nominee and a Republican Senate. And even though the Senate is close, as you guys saw on that map, there are a lot of Democrats in red states. And I don't think they want to oppose a candidate that looks as kind of qualified and experienced as Kavanaugh. But to make my Democratic friends out there feel better, I think that Roberts and Kavanaugh, in their past jurisprudence, have shown they're looking out for the interests of the court as an institution. And what Professor McDaniel and I want to really kind of emphasize throughout this semester, it's hard to see with the Congress sometimes. There aren't many people in the Congress who are acting in the interest of the Congress, which is why their, you know, trust rating is so low and approval rating. The presidency, there's a little bit of that too with Trump. Whatever you think of President Trump, he doesn't seem to be kind of guarding the institution the way that Bush and Obama and others had done. The court's a different matter, though. I think the court has gone out of its way not to get involved in, certain kinds of questions. Roberts cast a deciding vote upholding the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. I think in large part, not because he actually thought there was a compelling legal argument, but because he didn't think the court should get involved and knock down a major piece of legislation, duly passed by a democratically elected institution. I think Roberts, remember Stephen Jesse, Professor Jesse's, ideological spectrum on the court that we saw last week? Don't be surprised if Roberts slides a little closer to Kennedy on that scale, and that Kennedy kind of slides, or that Kavanaugh would be kind of where Roberts is. That's my cheap prediction. And, you go broke predicting the court, but that's okay, I'm broke anyway, so, what do I care? All right, so, Professor McDaniel, you got a couple things you want to talk about. I queued up your Trump stuff on the board
here. So what I want to move to is less of a discussion of kind of politics and how the parties are competing with each other, and really policy. And one of the policies that is coming forward, or one of the ideas that's coming forward is from the Trump administration, specifically in regards to reducing the cost of prescription drugs. And so they set up kind of a task force to look into the importing of certain drugs, specifically those in which the patent has expired. And so they're not trying to bring in a bunch of different drugs from overseas that will compete with already established American drugs, but specifically those where the patent has expired, as a way to try to lower the cost of drug prices. And so there have been recent scandals where, if you think about the price of EpiPens going up, or if you think of the Martin Scarelli, where he increased the price of one drug by 5,000%. So he's referred to as the Farmer Bro. Again, he was the one who bought the Wu-Tang album only to go to jail. So that's what happens. But there are these concerns about the rising cost of pharmaceuticals, and this is really one of the major concerns that we're talking about, reducing the cost of healthcare. So one of the reasons why the U.S. has such high cost of pharmaceuticals and a lot of other technology is the U.S. is very open to new technology, where you find a lot of European countries argue that, look, we will not accept any new technology until you establish that it is significantly better than the already established technology. The U.S. allows for a lot more experimentation, things of that nature. And so because of this, a lot of new drugs are on the market. And with the new drugs, the costs go up, things of that nature. And a lot of times there's this fear that you're paying more for a new drug that's just as effective as the old drug, which is cheaper. However, the Trump administration is taking a very small set of drugs and saying these drugs no longer have a patent, therefore specialized populations. Can we look into importing them as a way to increase competition and lower the cost? And so this is really one of the pushes of the Trump administration. There's been pushback from the Republican Party, and you have pushback from pharmaceutical companies. Specifically, pharmaceutical companies are arguing that if you use drugs from overseas, you cannot check in terms of quality. However, people who are supporting are saying, look, the FDA oversees the quality or drugs that are created overseas already. And so that oversight exists. And so this argument by pharmaceutical companies is actually a moot argument. But their argument is basically, you know, look, we have better control, we have better quality standards, you don't know what's going on over there. And by the FDA doing this, you're undercutting quality standards. And so they don't want to say, hey, you're messing with our profits, you're undercutting quality. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this comes out over time. As you do see, there's a significant level of Republican opposition to this type of activity. However, you may see President Trump be able to woo some of the Republicans who are wary of this, as they may see benefits for this and the constituents over time.
Just a couple of quick points. It's a fascinating issue. I think it shows a couple things. The first is that Trump is a Republican, but he's a Republican largely as a matter of convenience, I think, in a lot of ways. It's, you know, he's shown on trade policy. He's shown on a variety, you know, with even the relationship with Russia. These are not traditional Republican positions on these issues. And that has worked to his advantage so far. He hasn't really lost much of the hardcore conservative support that you would think would be suspicious of some of the things that Trump has proposed. I mean, he has done tax cuts, and he's kind of paid attention to evangelicals, but it's not like, you know, Trump's attraction to evangelical whites has always been a bit of a mystery to me, given his past. But, you know, he does stuff like this. He kind of cuts across traditional party lines on some of these issues. And so I would encourage you guys, as you're obviously interested spectators with respect to the Trump administration, we all are as citizens and followers of politics. He's interesting, and the rhetoric and the tweeting sometimes gets in the way of some interesting things. Now, I'm not saying good or bad, but I'm saying this is not something you would necessarily expect from a Republican president. Now, there's a bit of a caveat there, and that is, Professor McDaniel suggested, seeking a way to, you know, kind of reduce regulation or get around regulation and stimulate competition is a very kind of Republican-y idea. But, you know, presidents don't tend to do these things. They don't tend to go around some of these existing bureaucracies. And so Trump, in that sense, is kind of shaking these things up. I've been involved in some surveys of people who use prescription drugs. And one of the things that really surprised me, maybe not, but the actual number surprised me, the percentage of people who are getting prescription drugs who go online who shop online for these drugs. And it's like, you know, a third of people who are getting prescription drugs on a regular basis. And the percentage of those who go online and who go to foreign sites to get their prescription drugs, and this is people who are admitting this in surveys, it's about 50% of those who go online. So if you take one third say they get their drugs online, half of those say they get them from foreign sources, that's 16 or 17% of Americans who are getting prescription drugs, yeah, who are getting their you know, prescription drugs from a foreign country, almost, unquestionably because of cost.
Yes.
So let's see, what else we got here? We got trade war.
So this leads us next to the trade war.
That's
so
right.
We think of President Trump trying to open up trade in terms of certain pharmaceutical drugs. We are seeing that he's trying to close down trade in other areas. And so there's a, and this is actually taken, really the next two things I'm going to talk about are taken from the Wonk blog in the Washington Post. So the Wonk blog, so W-O-N-K blog, is really policy analysis. And so you have a lot of data-driven analysis or discussions of various research that exist. And the discussion within the Wonk blog is there's this chart, and I think we can put the chart up.
We would like to, except we seem to be frozen here.
Frozen, okay, that's all right.
Yeah, we'll have to describe the chart.
So the chart really demonstrates where we're seeing price increases and price decreases for goods and services. And what we're finding is that services are becoming much more expensive. So
there's our chart.
There we go. Okay, education, medicine, things or medical care, things, these are becoming more expensive over time, but goods are actually becoming cheaper. And so there, in regards to inflation, things of that nature. So if you think of washing machines, cars, things of that nature, we see that goods, so those things that are basically traded globally, these goods, they have gone down in price, but services, which cannot be traded, have gone up in price. And so the fear is that if we start increasing tariffs, try to restrict the importation of certain goods from overseas, that we will see a rise in these prices. So we're already seeing a drastic rise in the price of services, expect to see a drastic rise in the price of goods. And so this idea of this trade war being beneficial for the U.S. has come under question. Now, the counter argument is that if we restrict trade, what we'll see is a boom to the U.S. economy. And so the U.S., even though things may be more expensive, Americans will have more money to spend on these things to make the American economy strong. And a second thing that's also important to note is that we have a lot of misconceptions about why we are seeing Americans import more goods. So why is it Americans used to lead in exporting, but now they're importing more goods? Really, the key thing to point to is if you look at World War I and World War II, they decimated the industries within Europe. And so because the European industry was decimated, the U.S. was able to take advantage of that because, again, the U.S. did not face much in terms of wars in the U.S. You have Pearl Harbor, but other than that, the U.S. was really unscathed, and U.S. production actually increased and was maintained because these European nations had to rebuild. And so because of this, the U.S. is able to gain a large market share in terms of exporting goods. But as these other countries rebounded and they were able to start manufacturing, the U.S. lost its market share. And so one of the reasons why you saw this pocket or this window of U.S. manufacturing and this kind of golden age of U.S. manufacturing is a consequence of World War I and World War II, where you saw European nations and their industries being decimated, and they're just now rebounding, and the U.S. is now feeling the effects of that rebound. But this is an important thing to be aware of as we talk about this idea of the trade war, increasing tariffs going forward, and what exactly are the costs of this? So where should we expect to see an increase in certain goods and services, where we might expect to see a decrease? It's very clear that things such as washing machines, cars, TVs, goods are where we're going to expect to see an increase over time, even though we've seen a steady decrease. But services will still continue to increase in terms of their cost, something that really globalization has no effect on.
Well, I think, you know, once again, it's kind of consistent with the point we raised earlier about Trump pursuing policies are not traditional Republican policies. In fact, Democrats haven't touched much on trade issues. They've sort of Mau Mau these sorts of issue positions when they're speaking to union members and, you know, kind of key elements of what we refer to as the New Deal coalition, the traditional Democratic coalition that you see in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio. But it hasn't come up a whole lot lately. The traditional cry here is that, as Professor McDaniel suggests, is that the American worker is being hosed by these tariffs that exist in other countries, right? That, you know, we sense the stuff is produced in China or stuff is produced in India because the labor is so cheap, right? And then they don't let our goods and services into their countries because they're protecting, you know, all of their markets. And we're going to start getting, you know, we're going to level the playing field. And so this trade war reflects that mentality where, you know, the United States is no longer going to have basically no entry barriers while these other countries have all of these barriers. The classic example back from, you know, my time in the 80s was Japan, right? You know, the United States got all these goods and services from Japan, but, you know, Japan would not allow, you know, U.S. farmers to, you know, export rice to Japan. Right, so that's kind of the mentality, and Trump is basically like, well, we're going to stop that, but there are consequences to doing that. And you know, Professor McDaniel hit the nail on the head. The biggest thing, the easiest trade-off that you guys can probably envision here is, this might be better for U.S. workers, right? That these barriers were going to help protect some U.S. industries, at the cost of prices, though. You know, who benefits from these kind of more free market-oriented solutions and low trade barriers? Basically, consumers like you or me, people of the middle class who get cheap milk, who get cheap cars, who get cheap appliances, that doesn't happen as much if you erect these trade barriers, right? Prices will probably go up for consumers like you or me, but it may be better for people who work in particular industries. That's kind of the trade-off. And Trump, look, Trump's doing what he said he was going to do. He's trying to deliver on these promises to the people in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan who got him elected, right? So I think that's a big part of what's going on. Whether Americans like the trade-off, right, maybe higher inflation, higher goods and services in exchange for, you know, protecting workers in certain industries, you know, we'll see.
Yes.
We'll see. All right. So, and we're going to close, as we like to, with marijuana.
That's right. So our last policy discussion, again, this comes from the Washington Post Wonk blog, is does marijuana legalization, what are the, I guess, costs and benefits of it? And so a study which has looked at the state of Washington and the state of Colorado, which have legalized marijuana, what they found is that there's no negative effects associated with legalization of marijuana. And they have found some positive effects, specifically in terms of police officers being able to clear cases dealing with violent crimes. And so the argument, as this chart demonstrates, is that over the period of the legalization of marijuana, you've seen that police are able to focus efforts on other types of crimes. And so they've been able to spend more time on clearing cases related to violent crime. And this has been a constant argument that people put forward towards the legalization of marijuana, that if police spend less time prosecuting people for marijuana and more time on more serious crimes, that this will benefit society overall. And there is some evidence that, yes, police are clearing violent crime rates at a higher rate than before. Now, does this make society better? It's not really clear. But one of the things that people argued that we'd see a drastic change in terms of how police operate and where they focus their time, it's clear that they were able to spend more time on dealing with violent crime when they're not dealing with, I guess, minor charges such as marijuana. Now, whether or not this leads to a better society and whether or not the lack of a negative effect of marijuana will persist really isn't clear, but these are things that'll develop as time goes on.
Let's go back to that chart for a sec. I want to take a look at that if we could, because I think it's a really interesting chart. We've actually gone to our hard copies of these things because our tablet's frozen. Technology is a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is. These
lines are really interesting. They show exactly what Professor McDaniel says. So you're seeing these cut points between the legalization, post-legalization versus pre-legalization. Although I swear those relationships, so those are lines that summarize the overall trends, right? Man, look at those data points, so especially in Washington State. There's a lot of variance around that central line tendency.
Yes, there.
So Professor McDaniel was right to use it. There is, and by the way, I think the logical relationship we're talking about here, that is, what happens with policing if police are no longer forced to deal with these penny ante, marijuana possession charges, it seems quite logical that they would be freed up to do that. But I would suggest that trend line in Colorado is barely negative. And then the post-legalization. And then the one in Washington, there's a lot of variance around those central tendencies. So for those of you who are used to kind of looking at graphs and summarized data, I'd encourage you to kind of, pause here and take a look at those things and kind of see how compelling you think the overall evidence is. I don't know, seen some articles on this, particularly with respect to the budget impact in Colorado. In Colorado, I'd be making the figure up, but I want to say it's like $250 million or something. Some really, really, and please check me on that because I did just make that up. For some reason, that number sticks out of my mind. That is a lot of money. A lot of the times the argument has been, it's not just, Scooby-Doo Democrats who make the argument for legalization. There are a lot of Republicans making the argument for legalization on two grounds. One, the grounds that Professor McDaniel just mentioned, which is it frees up policing. The second ground is fiscal. Rather than have a black market for this where, guys named Taco Joe make money, this money goes to the state and is reinvested in, usually education is usually what it's tag marked for. Now, having said that, it's a complicated issue, right? I mean, I was talking about this with some friends, so the drinking age is 21. What's the legal age for pot? And, what about children and selling to children? There was a conference at Denver I went to, so I got to see one of these marijuana shops up close. And one of the things that was really interesting to me is that place is locked down. Okay. I mean, you cannot get in unless you show your ID, you're of a certain age. It is completely monitored with all sorts of, security equipment and things like that. It's a pretty high-end, type shop. I was surprised.
Plus, they can only deal in cash.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting. So, just another anecdote, and we'll get you guys out of here. I was watching an episode of The Prophet with Marcus Lemonis, or I think that's his name, who goes around and uses his own money to invest in these businesses and helps fix them up. He did a whole thing on marijuana in California, and the question was, should I invest in one of these marijuana growing operations in California where certain kinds of pot growing are legal? And there were a couple of counties out in the desert, out in the East Desert, near Palm Springs and Palm Desert, and they were basically kind of out of money, and they rented public grounds, public held lands, I should say, to some of these marijuana growers, and they essentially eradicated their public debt by virtue of this. But Marcus, the prophet, is the show on CNBC that I'm referring to. He basically raised this question. He said the problem from an investment point of view is, yeah, the state says it's legal, but there are still federal laws against doing this. What happens if the feds decide to come out here and seize everything? And I've invested in this, operation, and it's legal by state laws, but if the feds decide to come crack down on me, I mean, I lose my entire investment. So it was an interesting question from a business point of view, as well as Professor McDaniel says, that the business is just one angle of this huge public policy issue involving policing and law enforcement and, public funds funds for public enterprises, especially government. It's really fascinating. But as a public opinion guy, one thing that's clearly happened is that opposition to, and I would say, well, let's be clear, decriminalizing pot. Opposition to decriminalizing pot has gone down, down, down. There are very few people who strongly support keeping pot, small possessions of pot, still having it be illegal.
Yes, so it's important to understand the difference between making it illegal and decriminalization. So right. Massachusetts has decriminalized certain amounts of marijuana. If you're in possession of certain amounts of marijuana, it basically means it's not legal for you to have it, but we're not going to prosecute.
Right.
And that's a little bit different. And so decriminalization means that if you have it, we're not going to prosecute. And I think when people think about like Amsterdam or things like that, it's not that it's legal, it's that there are just certain areas where like, we're just not going to prosecute it. And whereas opposed to California, where they have made it legal, or Washington and Colorado, where it is legal, But again, there are certain places where you can smoke and certain places you can't smoke, and certain people who are allowed to and certain people who can't.
That's right. Some places it's medicinal marijuana, and in other places therapeutic marijuana, but different laws, different states. This is this patchwork quilt of federalism that, you know, Professor McDaniel and I have talked about in some of the lecture modules also. So, all right, that's all we have for week number two.
Have a good week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.